The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article is Drama in Real Life, Cougar Attack. The friends thought they were in for a nice, easy bike ride until an unexpected predator showed up. By Derek Burnett. Under a flat winter night, five women pedaled their bicycles up a gravel road through a northeastern forest where the trees stand pale and stark and leafless. These are not casual weekend cyclists. They are seasoned, competitive backcountry riders who spend more days in the saddle than out. Most of them ride for a team called Recycled Cycles Racing, based out of Seattle, and their accomplishments include multi-day endurance races on steep forest roads and trails all across the state of Washington. Today, Saturday, February 17th, 2024, began blustery, but now has calmed and settled into good riding conditions, with temperatures in the low 40s. The women have set out upon what is for them a relatively easy ride, a 35-mile loop of gravel road and forest trail through the foothills of the Cascade Mountains, about 30 minutes east of Seattle. They have dubbed this route the Magic Carpet Ride because part of it undulates through shimmering kudzu and emerald mosses. It's contained entirely within the 90,000-acre Snoqualmie Tree Farm, known to riders as Campbell Global, the farm's corporate owner. Right now, they're making their way up a gentle grade on a gravel road wide enough for side-by-side riding. In the lead are Erica Wolf, 51, an attorney, and Tish Schmidt-Williams, 58, a salesperson. In the middle of the pack, 60-year-old Carrie Berger, a provider relations advocate for a health insurance company, rides on her own. Bringing up the rear some 200 yards behind, Berger are Awn Teets, 59, a real estate agent, and Annie Belota, a 64-year-old retired gardener. The land to the right of the road, sparsely wooded, descends to a river far below. To the left lies a narrow ditch, and then a steep embankment shouldering up the thicker forest. Belota and Teets have a clear view of Berger up ahead of them, and farther on, Wolf and Schmidt-Williams. Suddenly, they see two tawny animals emerge from the sparse woods off to the right, just after Berger passes. Belota's and Tietz's minds stutter for a moment, trying to identify the animals behind their friend. Are they coyotes? Bobcats? No, they're cougars. No sooner have the friends identified the animals then the unimaginable happens. The first cat darts across the roadway, charges up the steep embankment on the left, and vanishes. The second appears set to follow, but in the last instant it pauses, distracted by the movement of Berger's bicycle. In a microsecond, the animal's intentions change. It springs onto Berger's back, pulls her to the ground with tooth and claw, and drags her like a rag doll into the ditch. Teets lets out a blood-curdling scream, and Belota yells, "No!" Up ahead, Schmidt-Williams and Wolf whirl around just in time to see their friend getting pulled off the roadway. Terror seizes the women. Their survival instincts urge them to put as much distance as possible between themselves and this apex predator. Instead, they push down their fear and, trembling with adrenaline, rush in to help their friend. Cougar attacks are rare. In the past 100 years, only 24 of these great cats have made contact with humans in the state of Washington. And most of the encounters can't even really be called attacks. A cat jumps on a camouflaged hunter, quickly realizes its mistake, and flees in mortal terror. Or a foolhardy dog tangles with a cougar, and in its adrenalized owner rushes in to kick at the cat until it races away. As it happens, The most recent cougar attack occurred right here in Campbell Global in 2018. Two cyclists were riding together when a cat pulled one of them off his bike. The second rider fled on foot, but the cougar abandoned its initial prey to run down and kill the fleeing man. These women all know this story. In fact, Berger told Schmidt Williams, who had recently moved to the area from Indiana, about it the first time they met. "Be careful," Berger said. "There are a lot of cougars up there." The 2018 attack underscored two important lessons. The first was, don't run. Fleeing triggers a cougar's predatory instinct, and no human could possibly hope to outrun a wildcat. These women remember that lesson well, and they now approach Berger and the marauding cougar quickly but cautiously, taking care not to break into a run. The second lesson is to carry bear spray in the backcountry. Unfortunately, none of these otherwise well-prepared women have bear spray with them today. When the cat attacks her, Berger sees a fleeting glimpse in close-up of the cougar's face. An instant later, she's lying in the ditch, fighting for her life as the animal sinks its teeth around her jawbone. Berger scrabbles and paws at the cougar, trying to get it to release her, but it clamps down relentlessly. "It's going to go for my throat," she thinks, instinctively throwing her left arm across her neck to protect herself. With the other hand, she seeks out the animal's eye socket to blind or stun it, even to gouge its eye out. But the sensation is of poking at tough cow leather, entirely without effect. Next, she drives her fingers up the creature's nostrils. It holds her jaw as firmly as ever, completely unfazed. On Teets has closed the distance and now lifts her bicycle and carries it towards the cat, shrieking wordlessly as she approaches. She knows that in an encounter with a predator, you should make yourself appear larger and be as loud as possible. The cat ignores her entirely. Berger is lying on her left side, head pointed back downhill, the direction from which they've come. The cat is sprawled on its right side, its maw gripping Berger's face in the sickeningly intimate interplay of predator and prey. One of the cat's long canine teeth is sunk into her face, just beneath her right temple, another near her chin. Its forepaws clasp at her neck and shoulders, its hind feet press at her knees and thighs. For an instant, Teets locks eyes with the cat, and she is struck by the beauty of the glowing amber eyes and the raw power behind the pitiless gaze. She knows that the cougar will not let go of her prey. It has what she wants, Teets realizes. It's about to do whatever it does with prey. I need to stop it. Her attention falls on the cougar's rear legs. The claws are as long as her little fingers. She must get them off her friend before the cat slices her to ribbons. Teets moves behind the cougar, seizes its left hind leg in one hand and its tail in the other, and yanks the animal clear of Berger's lower body. But the jaws still hold. Annie Bellota is only a step or two behind Teets. She sees Berger fighting for her life, hears her grunt, "Get it off me! Get it off me!" and immediately goes for the animal's throat, thinking to choke it to unconsciousness. But the muscles are so solid that it's like wrapping her hands around a tree trunk. She lets go and begins stomping at the cougar's stomach, still to no avail. "Grab his front legs, Annie," Teets says. Bellota grabs one of the creature's forelegs. "You're not getting this back," she mutters through gritted teeth. Schmidt Williams and Wolf, who have now made their way to the scene, are stunned by what they see. Teets starts calling out instructions. "Call 911, she tells Wolf. "Find some sticks or stones," she says to Schmidt Williams, "and keep an eye out. There were two cougars." Terrified that the second cat might attack at any moment, Wolf takes out her cell phone and places an emergency call. Miraculously, they have a signal. A little farther up the trail, and they would have been out of luck. She begins describing the situation to the 911 dispatcher, who asks for the GPS coordinates. Wolf falters. "We're in Campbell Global, but we don't know exactly where we are." "I need your coordinates." "Erica," Teets calls out, "we need everybody over here." Wolf sets her phone on the ground and joins in the fight against the cougar. Tish Schmidt-Williams has collected a stout 4-foot stick and a rock the size of a small watermelon. She seizes the rock, hoists it over her head, and slams it onto the cougar's ribcage, certain she's delivering a killing blow. But the cat's deadly teeth remain fixed in Bergere's face. Once a top-10 runner in the state of Indiana, Schmidt-Williams is no stranger to feats of endurance. But she exhausts herself lifting and slamming down the rock, dozens of repetitions, all to no effect. "Erica," Bellota says to Wolf, "in my bag is a multi-tool with a knife on it." Wolf finds the tool, which has a 2-inch serrated blade. She approaches the cat and begins stabbing at its ribs and lower abdomen. Meanwhile, Schmidt-Williams puts down the rock and grabs the stick, swinging it repeatedly into the same area of the animal's hide. For 15 minutes, the women grapple, bash, stab, and club at the cougar, and for 15 minutes, it holds Bergere just as tightly as when it first grabbed her, perhaps even more tightly. Bergere, bloody and torn, has not stopped fighting, still jabbing her fingers into the animal's face while trying to protect her throat. Bellota thrusts her hand into the cat's bloody mouth in an attempt to pry open its jaws, but gives up. Teets grabs the rock and holds it high. "I'm going to hit it over the head," she tells Bergere. "I'm sorry if I hit you." "Just kill it," Bergere says, gurgling. Teets slams the rock onto the animal's head. It ignores the blow as if it never happened. Gradually, it dawns on the group that if the cougar releases Bergere, it might turn on any or all of them. "We have to grab this bike," Schmidt-Williams says, indicating Wolf's bicycle, which is closest to them. "If this thing gets up, we can put the bike on top of it." Bergere, too, wonders what she will do if the cat lets go. She's in no position to crawl away, so she gathers her strength and rolls from her left side more onto her belly, hoping to get her knees and elbows beneath her. Too late, she realizes this was a mistake. Now her mouth and nose are pressed into the ground, stifling her breathing. At the same time, something has changed in her mouth. The cat has fractured her jaw, and she feels as if her teeth are breaking free and sliding down her throat, along with so much blood that she fears she will drown in it. For the first time, she wonders if she is going to die. A vision plays across her mind of her two distraught daughters planning her funeral. And then, suddenly, the cat relaxes its jaws. "Go, Carrie, go, go," Bellota yells. Bergere rolls away from the predator as her friends lay Wolf's bicycle across its body. "Get on, get on," the women yell to each other. Each of the four friends finds a place to stand on the bike's frame and wheels, pinning the cat. It struggles to rise, but the combined weight of the women, some 450 pounds, holds it down. Bergere, still gagging on blood but amazed to be alive, struggles to her feet in the middle of the roadway. Should she help her friends? "Lie down," Carrie Teet says. "Don't try to stand." She stretches out in the gravel, bloody, weary, and mangled, but breathing and conscious. "Hello, ma'am? Hello, ma'am?" It's the 911 dispatcher's voice coming through Wolf's phone on the ground right beside them. Teets puts it up to her ear, but there's no sound. She hangs up and redials. This time she gets through. "It's the women with the cougar attack," she tells the dispatcher. "I need help for a badly injured cyclist, and I need someone with a gun because we've got the cougar pinned down." The dispatcher still needs the group's coordinates, so Bellota steps off the bicycle to retrieve her GPS device from her own bike. The animal begins thrashing and fighting to stand. "Get back here! Get back here!" the other women shout. Bellota grabs her device, rejoins them on the bicycle, and reads the coordinates to Teets and the dispatcher. Wolf has a coagulant bandage in her first aid kit in the bike they're standing on. Leaning over, she pulls it out and tosses it towards Bergère, but it falls short. Bellota is desperate to tend to her friend, but doesn't dare leave the bike again. Then it occurs to her that she can use the heavy rock they hit the cougar with as a substitute for some of her weight. It's sitting on the ground next to the bike. She lifts it onto the bike, steps off, and makes sure it holds the cougar down. Bellota picks up the bandage, places it on Bergère's face, and covers her with an emergency blanket from her bag, along with the coats of the other cyclists. Then she gets down on the ground and nestles against her friend to share her body heat. Bellota looks down the trail in the direction from which help will be coming. But when? What she sees are two cyclists pedaling up the hill. As the pair draws nearer, the women realize it's people they know, two more of their teammates, Daniel Perry and Elise Cassell. It takes Perry and Cassell a moment to register the surreal scene, Bellota in the road tending to someone whose bloodied head is mauled beyond recognition, and three more of their teammates perched on a bicycle on top of a cougar. But they don't gawk for long. "Get on and help us hold it down," Teach shouts. Cassell is a certified wilderness first responder. While Perry adds his weight to that of the women holding down the growling cougar, she takes Bergère's pulse, normal, and checks for bleeding elsewhere on her body. None. Bergère, who has remained conscious, communicates through signs, no longer able to speak through her mangled mouth. About half an hour after the cat released Bergère, and 45 minutes since the attack, an officer pulls up to the scene in a State of Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, WDFW, service truck. He steps out of the vehicle and approaches Bellota and Bergère lying in the road. "She's okay," Bellota says. "Go kill the cougar first." The officer tells Barry to step off the pike, but orders the women to remain on it. He places the muzzle of his sidearm against the cougar's thickly furred chest and fires once. The women have braced for the firearm's loud report, but the shot is muffled, anticlimactic. The animal twitches for a few minutes, then goes still. The nightmare is over. WDFW officials autopsied the cougar and found it to be a male, about 8 months old. A kitten, technically, though the term doesn't do justice to the cat's 75-pound bulk. At that age, a cougar will be dependent on its mother for at least another 10 months. It is just beginning to take the lead on hunting turkeys or small rabbits, usually nothing larger. The second cougar, seen that day, appeared to be similar in size to the first, so it's possible that the pair were orphaned siblings. Richard Beausoleil, the resident cougar expert at WDFW, says that everything the cougar did that day, deciding to attack a cyclist, biting the head instead of the neck, refusing to let go, speaks to the animal's youth and inexperience. Adults know what they're capable of, he says. They know they don't have to go after everything. This one maybe had never even seen a human before. The women all deeply regret the loss of the cougar's life. I mean, he had to die, Annie Bellota says. But that's not what we were setting out to do. He just made a bad decision that day. Carrie Bergère spent 5 days in the hospital, with surgeons working for 9 hours to repair her head and jaw. Her mandible had been severely fractured, and she now has an implanted metal reinforcement, which she says on an X-ray looks uncannily like a section of a bicycle chain, from her right ear to her chin, and another over the top portion of her mouth. Both of her ears were badly torn and needed to be sewn back together. She also suffered puncture wounds and scratches on her hands, shoulders, and neck, some requiring stitches. She sports a permanent dent near her temple and a scar along her lip, chin, and neck. "But it's part of my story," she says. When WDFW officers brought her flowers in the hospital, the men were hushed and somber. So Bergère decided to lighten the mood. "Flowers?" she said. "I wanted a tooth or a claw." A few days later, the officers returned with a surprise. Not a tooth or claw, but something even better. One of her earrings, which had been found in the cougar's belly. Bergère ordered identical pairs for all four of her friends as a token of gratitude for risking their own lives to save hers that day. When they visited her in the hospital, hunkered around her bed, they looked bravely at her swollen, scarred face, and Bergère felt a rush of immense gratitude. "This is not a tragedy," she told her friends as the tears welled in their eyes. "This is such a great thing, a great moment. To be alive together." That was Cougar Attack by Derek Burnett. Our second article is a health-related piece, Snap, Crackle, Pop, What's Normal with Our Joints and How to Prevent Pain and Problems by Patricia Varacayo. Adults typically have 206 bones and 350 joints, which are made of bones plus the tissues that hold the bones together, cartilage, tendons, ligaments, and nerves. With so many moving parts working hard every day, it's no wonder that many people experience pain, stiffness, or soreness in one or more of these connections. The smallest joint in the body is in the ear, and while it plays a crucial role in hearing, most of us aren't even aware it's there. The largest joint is in the knee. Knees and other large joints like hips, shoulders, and elbows are the ones that tend to become painful. We're often quick to blame joint pain or stiffness on getting older. But it's not just older folks who experience joint pain. Athletes and just plain everyday active people experience joint pain too. Besides aging, causes include overuse, example osteoarthritis, inflammation, bursitis or tendonitis, injury, strains, sprains, and fractures, and genetic or autoimmune condition, lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. It's perfectly normal for people to have occasional aches and pains in their joints, says Kyle Roigrock, a physician, a physical therapist with Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine and Rehabilitation in Houston. Most problems in the joints are either from trauma or overuse. And, he adds, many of those problems can be relieved simply by resting the following day to allow for recovery. When pain lasts longer, doctors have a variety of ways to treat it, depending on where and why it occurs and how severe it is. The first recommendations may be supportive tools like canes, braces, and splints to help reduce strain and prevent falls from achy knees and hips. Smaller aids, for arthritic finger joints, for instance, can include special jar openers, ring splints, or voice-to-text software to avoid typing. Your doctor may also recommend anti-inflammatory medications, NSAIDs, or a steroid injection to help relieve pain. Physical therapy is another valuable option for rebuilding strength and mobility, particularly after an injury or arthritis diagnosis. Roigrock recommends considering it if your joint pain hasn't improved after 4 to 6 weeks. When these measures no longer provide relief and joint pain begins to significantly impact your daily activities, that's when we typically start discussing surgical options, says Nicholas Nassau, MD, an orthopedic surgeon at University of Iowa Healthcare. Of course, preventing joint pain is preferable to treating it once it occurs. While you can't always avoid it, injuries and aging happen, there's a lot you can do to protect your joints, reduce inflammation, and stay mobile. Here's what medical experts recommend. Stay active and stretch regularly. Exercises like walking, cycling, and swimming keep joints lubricated and muscles strong. Strength training helps support major joints like knees and hips. Lower impact activities are more sparing to the joints, but all activity, sports, working out is good, says Dr. Nosso. Daily stretching, especially hips, hamstrings, and shoulders, can ease tension and improve mobility. Yoga or Pilates may also boost flexibility and relieve stress. Watch your weight. According to the Arthritis Foundation, losing just 10 pounds can relieve 40 pounds of pressure from your knees and help slow joint degeneration. Eat to fight inflammation. A diet low in sugar and fats and rich in protein and vegetables is the best for a healthy musculoskeletal system, says Dr. Nassau. A Mediterranean-style diet rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, lean proteins, and healthy fats has been shown to reduce inflammation and support joint health. Practice good posture and ergonomics. Wear supportive shoes. If you work at a computer, keep your screen at eye level and maintain neutral wrist and arm positions while typing. Take frequent breaks. Wear protective equipment. Depending on your activity, knee pads, wrist guards, elbow pads, and ankle braces can all help prevent injury in vulnerable joints. Try dietary supplements, with your doctor's okay. Supplements like glucosamine, chondroitin, hyaluronic acid, or turmeric or garlic extracts may offer mild relief, though research is mixed. Occasional aches and pains are normal, but take note when joint pain becomes severe or chronic or interferes with daily activities. Knowing the red flags can help you catch serious issues early and prevent long-term damage. If you're experiencing any of the following symptoms, experts say it's time to get them checked out. Swelling, redness, or heat, these can indicate inflammation, gout, or infection, especially if the pain is accompanied by fever or affecting multiple joints. Joint deformity or immobility, a visibly misshapen joint or an inability to move it may signal a fracture or dislocation that needs urgent care. Possible infection, a single hot, red, swollen joint plus a fever could mean septic arthritis. Seek medical help immediately. Loss of motion or function. Gradually decreasing range of motion or strength may point to progressive joint damage. Unexplained symptoms. Fatigue, rashes, dry eyes or mouth, chest pain, or digestive issues with joint pain could suggest an autoimmune disease. Severe or persistent pain. If the pain wakes you, limits daily activity, or hasn't improved after 3 days of rest, don't ignore it. That was Snap, Crackle, Pop by Patricia Varakayo. We've run out of time for today's episode. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.